Okay, so just to remind you where we ended up last time, we summarized all the laws of electricity, magnetism, and magnetism, i.e., Maxwell's equations. In these two equations. So, just to remind you, these indices, alpha, beta, go from 0, 1, 2, 3. This index is for CT. These indices are spatial indices. And we have this matrix, e to alpha beta, which is diagonal. We also have its inverse, e to with upstairs indices. We have derivatives. We needed this eta because you'll notice in these equations, the f in this equation has upper indices, but here it has lower indices. And the way to go from upper to lower is using eta. So eta was essential in these equations. We had partial derivatives, we had the current, which is the charge density times C and the current density. And we had this tensor epsilon alpha beta gamma delta, the totally antisymmetric tensor with epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 equals 1. So with all of that notation, we're able to write these equations down. And this was the foundation for relativity. Because once you have the equations written in this form, it is obvious there is a certain symmetry. Okay? So let me describe what the symmetry is. Which is known as Lorentz invariance. And this was discovered by Lorentz in 1904, and it's worth looking at his paper. Obviously, he didn't have this notation, so everything is much more clumsy and cumbersome, but he noticed there was a symmetry which involves space and time and the electric and magnetic fields. The symmetry is the following, that you see, if I think about classical mechanics, everybody was used to the fact that the equations of classical mechanics, for example, the equation of motion for a particle, that F equals ma, mass times the acceleration is equal to minus the gradient of the potential, that equation is obviously rotational invariant. Obviously, invariant under x being changed to x prime, which is a rotation matrix times x. So this is a 3 by 3 rotations, and O transpose O equals 1. Because if you look at this equation, if I just rotate, if I just prime everything, the prime is just O times X. And so so this goes, this, if I prime everything, this is MX double dot prime minus equals minus, well, let's put them all on the left-hand side. This equals zero. So if I calculate this quantity plus grad prime V, this is obviously equal to the rotation matrix, which is just a constant matrix, times MX double dot plus grad V. And that was zero by the original equation. So you can see that priming everything, changing to the new coordinate system, leaves the original equation satisfied. That's clear because if I have some mechanical system which is evolving, what are the coordinates x anyway? Well, they were totally arbitrary. I mean, I could use for x, y, and z, I can use the height from that corner, the length along here, the length along the wall, except it's not quite at right angles, but imagine it was at right angles. And that would be my x, y, z, but I could equally well just rotate the coordinate system and use those. There's nothing to prefer one over the other, and the equations are rotational invariant. Okay, so everyone was used to that fact. What they were not used to was rotations in space and time, and that's what Lorentz noticed. So Lorentz transformation is a rotation in space and time, which is that x prime alpha is lambda alpha beta x beta. You have to be careful about upstairs and downstairs indices and to keep track of them. So x has an upstairs index. When I rotate x, I multiply with a matrix. This index is summed. So that's the analog of matrix. It is just matrix multiplication. This means a 3x3 matrix multiplied by a vector. This is the same thing, except I've written the indices out. And then, of course, it follows from this that this means that dx, sorry, partial d by dx alpha, which is dx prime beta by dx alpha d by dx prime beta is equal to lambda beta alpha d by dx prime alpha. Okay, and so if we're going to express derivatives with respect to the prime coordinates in terms of derivatives with respect to the original coordinates, I've got to invert this matrix lambda. Okay, because I want to multiply, I have to multiply that equation by the inverse. So what we'll do is define a lambda twiddle matrix. So we have lambda alpha beta and lambda twiddle beta gamma. This guy's the inverse of lambda. So I'm using just ordinary matrix multiplication. And that, by definition, is delta alpha gamma. And so then this implies, this equation implies d by dx prime alpha is lambda twiddle beta alpha d by dx beta. Okay, so this is simple enough to remember that upper indices transform with lambda, and down and lower indices transform with lambda twiddle, the inverse of lambda. So let's think of all the different quantities we have. Let me write down another equation. If lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda, go ahead.
Isn't it if an index is?
I've got this index wrong.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. Thanks a lot. Indices. Indices should be contracted.
Yeah.
The indices on the left and the right have to match, and when I contract two indices, that sort of removes them. Thank you. I think I got this one right. Any other questions? Okay, so let's think about all the. I was just in the middle of saying this equation. That lambda twiddle is 1, because lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda. If lambda twiddle is the right inverse of lambda, it's also the left inverse of lambda. Okay, that's a theorem from linear algebra. So it also follows that lambda twiddle beta gamma lambda gamma alpha is delta beta alpha. Okay, so lambda twiddle is the inverse on either the left or the right of lambda. And so let's think about all the quantities we have in the Maxwell equations. We have the current. So this is going to transform like a 4-vector. Just has one index. We have the field strength tensor. That's got 2 indices. That's going to transform with 2 lambda matrices. Okay, and obviously the field strength tensor with lowered indices is going to transform with 2 lambda twiddles. If I have a quantity, well, let's say it this way, 2 contracted indices, do not transform. Or let's say transform trivially. Trivially means without any lambdas. So for example, if I have A alpha, B alpha, one up and one down, then if I prime this guy, I get lambda alpha beta A beta times lambda twiddle alpha gamma B gamma. But lambda twiddle is delta gamma beta, so that's equal to A gamma B gamma. So if you have contracted indices, you don't need to bother inserting any lambdas. Finally, let's think about this epsilon factor. We don't really need it in the Maxwell equations. We wrote it out in a form which doesn't involve epsilon, but let's do it anyway. It's useful for future. That epsilon alpha beta gamma delta prime, this is, of course, epsilon chi psi. I'm running out of Greek letters. Let me not use epsilon. That's too confusing. Xi times lambda, alpha, chi, lambda, beta, psi, lambda, gamma, eta, lambda, delta, xi. Okay. And again, from linear algebra, the epsilon tensor multiplied by a matrix to the appropriate powers when I contract with one index of the matrix. Do you know what this is equal to?
Determinant, exactly. So this is from linear algebra. When I form this quantity out of a matrix, this is just equal to epsilon alpha beta gamma delta times the determinant of lambda. So this is one way to define the determinant. It is exactly identical to the usual expression. If you're used to writing out the matrix and then doing this whole process of calculating the determinant by this times the subdeterminants and all that, it's completely equivalent to just writing this out. Okay, and so now what is the determinant of lambda? Well, we know that lambda, I haven't even said it yet. There's one very important property of lambda, in fact, the defining property of lambda. So let me say that. Most important is what about the eta? Well, that eta matrix is defined to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? And if we want the equations to be valid in the new coordinate system, it better have the same eta. Otherwise, it won't be the same equations. So the most important transformation we have to use is that eta prime mu nu, or let's do it with upstairs indices first. Eta prime alpha beta, which is lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta eta gamma delta, that better equal to eta alpha beta. So eta is invariant under Lorentz transformations. So actually, this is the defining property. Defining property of Lorentz transformations. And we can write it as a matrix. In a matrix form, that lambda eta lambda transpose equals eta. You see, if I look at that equation there, let's just write it out, lambda alpha, what indices did he have? Gamma, lambda beta, delta, eta, gamma, delta. Clearly, this matrix multiplying eta, that's a normal matrix product. But this one is being multiplied with the second index. Okay, so the row column here is going with the column there. And so you can write this, you can check that actually this is equivalent to the statement that lambda eta lambda transpose is eta. And this, of course, implies that if I take the determinant of this equation, the determinant of a product of matrices is the product of the determinants. Okay, and the determinant of a transpose is the determinant of the matrix. So this implies that the determinant of lambda, determinant of eta is just minus 1. Eta equals det eta, det lambda squared. And so this implies determinant of lambda equals, this is equal to minus 1. Determinant lambda is plus or minus 1. So the Lorentz transformation matrices come in two types. One of them has determinant plus 1, and those Lorentz matrices, we say, are connected to the identity because they all have the same determinant as the identity. If you consider this matrix with some parameters, we'll do that in a minute, They, as you vary those parameters away from the identity, the determinant remains plus one. The other set of Lorentz transformations, their determinant's minus one, and it's disconnected from the identity. There's no smooth way to deform in the Lorentz transformations such a matrix to the identity. So we say this is the connected, and this is disconnected to the identity.
Doesn't the minus one times the identity, isn't that disconnected as well?
Sorry?
Isn't minus one times the identity disconnected as well?
No, because minus, if you take the Lorentz transformation, which is this, determinant is one.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's connected.
But can you path connect it to the identity?
Yes.
Okay.
If you like have a Lorentz transformation, though, that flips the time direction and then flips the spatial.
Yes, good point.
Couldn't it still have determinant one? And
yes, that's this guy.
It's this matrix.
That's exactly this one. So this one is flipping time and space. But the determinant is one. And it's actually connected to the identity. So we can try and construct this, but you're actually... okay, let me just... let me think about this.
It's just PT.
This is PT.
Yeah.
I don't understand what that means.
Parity inversion.
Yeah, in fact, I believe it's not connected to the energy.
Yeah,
I think
not.
You're right.
They're four connected.
I think you're right. There are four components. Sorry, what I said was wrong. There are four components. There are four components. We have time reversal, parity. Yeah, I could do this in more detail. I believe what happens when you analyze this equation carefully is that the lambda 0, 0 is always greater than 1. Is that correct? I think some of the matrices are lambda 0, 0 is bigger than 1, and some of them are less than minus 1. Okay? And it's a similar story with parity. So basically, there are, let me see. Yeah, we say there are four components, I believe. How should I say it?
So it's like...
Okay, so we have these two. We have det lambda equals plus or minus 1. And then I think we have lambda. It's probably easy to show, in fact, if we look at this equation. Because I won't try and do it now.
Okay.
But there are four components of the Lorentz group. One of them has determinant equal to 1, and time and parity are both even. Okay. One of them has time odd.
Parity odd,
and then
PT,
and then PT odd. Yeah, I can try and talk more about that. Okay, I'm not going to use this in the course at all. It's important in particle physics, but I'm not going to be using that at all. So let me just make a note here. The Lorentz group has four components. Let's say four connected components. if you look in any particle physics textbook, it explains that. It's all just derived from this equation. Okay, so here are Lorentz transformations. And what we have just shown is that if I take these equations here and I prime them,
just prime everything, they're still valid. And so that proves that because they're equal to lambda times the original equations, which were valid. Okay, this quantity primed is just lambda times the original quantity. This quantity primed is just lambda times the original quantity. So provided lambda is invertible, is an invertible matrix, you can remove it. This guarantees it's invertible because this guarantees its determinant is plus or minus 1. Condition for it to be invertible is that the determinant doesn't vanish. So these are symmetries of the Maxwell equations. So the most simple example of Lorentz transformation. So a simple example is just a rotation. That's a 2D rotation. Okay. So let's imagine that we had some coordinates x and y. These are just two of our spatial coordinates. And we rotate the coordinate system. So we measure x prime and y prime. We're going to rotate by some angle theta. So this angle is also theta. Then the value of x prime, so if this is, so if I consider some point here, which is x comma y, then the value of x prime is given by dropping the perpendicular to the x prime axis. Okay, so this quantity would be x, and this quantity would be x prime, and this quantity here would be y prime. Okay? And then it's just a matter of simple geometry. I'll leave it to you to show it, that you can show that x prime is x cos theta plus y sine theta, and y prime is y cos theta minus x sine theta. So just to spell it out, this x coordinate is, of course, that length, and the y coordinate is this length. Okay, so just using ordinary geometry, you can show that this is true. And it follows from this that x prime, let me just leave that as an exercise. Show that. And it follows from this that x prime squared plus y prime squared is x squared plus y squared. Lengths are invariant under rotations. Okay, so if I square x prime squared, I'm going to get x squared cos squared from this term. If I square y prime squared, I'll get x squared sine squared. The cos squared plus sine squared gives 1. The cross terms obviously cancel, because I get 2xy cos theta sine theta minus sign here. They cancel. And so you can see that this quantity equals x squared plus y squared. And so it follows that the Lorentz transformation, in which I do nothing to the time direction, but I rotate between x and y. So x and y are the second and third rows and columns. So if I just put a rotation in here, minus sine theta, cos theta, and zeros everywhere else. Okay, this is a valid Lorentz transformation. And you can check that
lambda eta lambda transpose equals eta. So that's not so interesting, something we already knew, that that physics is invariant under rotating coordinates. But let's try a Lorentz transformation involving time. And of course, when we involve time, we have to deal with this minus sign in the eta, which changes everything. So if we consider a Lorentz transformation involving time, the minus sign so just by playing around with it, you will find that you need to do the following. Cos theta becomes cosh theta, and sine theta becomes sinh theta. And minus sinh theta cosh theta, and then 1, 1. Zeros everywhere else. So this also satisfies lambda eta lambda transpose equals 1, equals eta. Okay, so Lorentz transformations are like, or time-dependent Lorentz transformations are like rotations, but where cosine changes to cosh and sine changes to sinh, and that's because of the minus sign. And so, so what this means is that ct prime is ct cosh theta minus x sinh theta, and x prime is x cosh theta minus ct sinh theta. And now you immediately see the difference with rotations, which is the quantity ct prime squared minus x squared, x prime squared, is equal to ct squared minus x squared. Or maybe I should put the minus sign here. It doesn't really matter, of course. But the key thing is that time comes with a minus sign. Okay, so let's check that. Ct prime squared, I'm going to get a minus cos squared times ct squared. And then here I'm going to get a plus sinh squared. So minus cos squared plus sinh squared is minus 1. So we're going to use this identity, minus sinh squared equals 1. Whereas before we used cos squared plus sine squared theta is 1. This minus sign here is extremely important, okay? It's basically the unique thing about gravity. It's what separates time from space. It sort of explains how the universe, why the universe depends on time. It's the root of many, many things. This minus sign is the most important minus sign in physics. Okay? It allows physics to exist, that minus sign. Otherwise, space and time would be the same, and nothing would ever change. So that minus sign is responsible for change in the world. It's a very important thing, and it will come up again and again and again in physics. How do we deal with this minus sign? Okay, so this is mathematics. This is the mathematical transformation. And then, of course, the genius of Einstein was to figure out what the physical meaning was of transformations like this. Lorentz just noticed it as a mathematical property. Einstein realized what the physical meaning was. And that changed everything. So 1 year after Lorentz had written this paper, Einstein wrote his paper which launched special relativity and essentially was just interpreting Lorentz's transformations as a physical property of the world. So the physical meaning is the following. If I think of space-time, coordinates, so treat time as just another coordinate, then of course I would describe the world as a collection of objects in space-time, moving around in this space-time arena. And the point of these transformations is that you can change coordinates, just as we could rotate the coordinates for this room without any physical consequence, we can do a Lorentz transformation on the coordinates on space-time. And so if we look at these coordinates and try to figure out what they mean, well, the CT prime axis is the locus on which x prime is 0, right? Just as the t-axis is the CT axis is the locus where x equals 0. So to get the CT prime axis, I set x prime equals 0. So that means x is CT tan theta. So the CT prime axis in this diagram, okay, this is CT equals x tan theta. It's just the locus x prime equals 0. And then the x prime axis is the locus CT prime equals 0. Right? Is that clear? I have these coordinates, x and CT, and what I mean by the CT prime axis is the set of points which all have x prime equals 0. What I mean by the x prime axis is the set of points which all have CT prime equals 0. So the x prime axis is where CT prime equals 0. So what I see here is that CT is x. Sorry, did I do it wrong? Yeah, I think I did this one wrong. The CT prime axis is where x prime equals 0, so CT is x over tan theta. Well, let's write it this way. X equals CT tan theta. Okay, so if you think about x, the relationship between x and ct, what it's saying is that it's a straight line whose slope is tan theta. This is less than 1. So if so basically the slope must be this way. The x prime axis, right, this is the locus ct prime equals 0. And so from here, you see ct is x tan theta. OK, and tan theta is less than 1. So Lorentz transformations are not rotations of the axes. What they correspond to is pushing the x prime axis up, tilting it upwards, and tilting the t axis this way. OK, so you're just taking these axes, and you're closing them like this. OK, and then, of course, the coordinates you define. So the locus of all points with a fixed value of x prime, they will be parallel to the CT prime axis, OK? And the locus of points of fixed CT prime will be parallel to the x prime axis, OK? I've drawn that quite badly. I'm sorry. Should all be parallel, OK? And So it's completely clear from this picture that all you're doing is changing coordinates. You've got this arena. You had your coordinates with perpendicular axes. You're now making non-perpendicular axes. But you're just covering the space with parallel lines. Every point has a coordinate. It's absolutely impossible for any inconsistency to arise. Okay? So from the geometrical picture, all you've done is change coordinates. Manifestly a consistent thing to do. So whenever you see a paper on the archive or anywhere else, and there are a million papers claiming to prove Einstein wrong, usually they miss this point. They get involved in algebra. They make some sign mistake somewhere. They say, oops, I found an inconsistency. It's absolutely impossible for an inconsistency to arise if all you're doing is you're changing coordinates from one system to another. Okay? So the arena of space-time is just being described in a different coordinate system. And now let's ask the, imagine somebody who's using the CT prime and X prime coordinates. What is different about them than the original, somebody using the X and CT coordinates? Well, an observer, O prime, using the CT prime and X prime coordinates, okay, is stationary in those coordinates. Okay, so in particular, this observer would say, well, I'm at x prime equals 0, for example. Okay, in other words, I'm just running up the CT prime axis. Okay, so that would be the trajectory of this observer. And they are moving. O prime is moving relative to an observer O, using the CT and X coordinates with a velocity. What is the velocity of O prime? Okay, so imagine you're now observer O, and you see this observer O prime running up here. Just fixed in X prime, but increasing in T prime. You would say they're moving, right? And they're moving according to this equation. Is moving with a velocity c tan theta. Because you're saying their coordinate in the O system, x equals c tan theta times t. So in other words, i.e., v equals c tan theta. And theta is called it's a dimensionless number called the rapidity. Clearly, in this picture, you cannot describe an observer moving faster than c, because tan theta is always less than or equal to 1. Okay, so no observer can have v bigger than c because tan theta is less than or equal to 1. And in fact, that's true with a magnitude sign. So we can't describe observers moving faster than the speed of light. We can only describe observers going up to the speed of light. So rapidity is the analog of angle.
rapidity of a Lorentz transformation is the analog of the angle theta of a rotation. It's a dimensionless parameter measuring the size of the transformation. For angles, they go from 0 to 2 pi, but rapidity goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. And as the rapidity changes, the velocity goes from minus c to plus c. So just to translate this into more traditional language, because remember the Lorentz transformation is this guy, I know what tan theta is now in terms of the velocity of the observer. So I just need to express cosh theta in terms of tan theta to see what the Lorentz transformation is. And this is a standard identity, tan theta squared, right? Because tan is cosh over sinh, and so cosh squared over, sorry, sinh squared over cosh. Sinh over cosh, so sinh squared over cosh squared, multiply through by the cosh squared, I get cosh squared minus sinh squared, which is 1. The cos squared, the cosh squared in the denominator comes to the numerator. And so this, of course, is equal to 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. And this is defined to be gamma in the usual way of writing Lorentz transformations. And likewise, the sinh theta, of course, is just cosh theta times tan theta. And so this is gamma times v over c. And so the Lorentz transformation, which we had over here, we called it, let's call it by that symbol, is just t prime equals gamma t minus vx over c squared. So I've just divided by c in this formula. Use the fact that cosh theta is gamma, sinh theta is gamma v over c, and then x prime is gamma x minus vt. And the inverse, well, in fact, the same Lorentz transformation. This is the relationship between the t x coordinates and the t prime x coordinates. You can invert that to find the relation between t and to express t and x in terms of t prime and x prime. And t is gamma t prime. So the inverse matrix lambda, you can check that lambda twiddle, all I do is reverse theta. Theta goes to minus theta, gives me the inverse matrix. So lambda twiddle is cosh, and then plus sinh, minus sinh, plus sinh, cosh. OK, you can see that because if I multiply first row by first column, I'm going to get cosh squared minus sinh squared, which is 1. First row by second column, I'm going to get cosh sinh minus cosh sinh, which is 0, etc. Okay, so this is the inverse matrix. And the inverse matrix is what comes into this relationship between t x and t prime x prime. So this is just plus v over c squared x prime. And x is equal to gamma x prime plus v t prime. OK, so using those formulae, we can easily go back and forth between the tx and t prime x prime coordinates. Uh-huh. notice that if x equals ct, okay, so that x equals ct is the trajectory of a particle at the speed of light, trajectory of particle moving at the speed of light, then x prime is gamma c minus v t, and t prime is gamma 1 minus v over c times t, and this implies that x prime equals c t prime. So anything moving at the speed of light does so for all observers. Okay, so now we come back to this issue of relativity, the inconsistency between Maxwell's result that there's a special speed, the speed of light, which failed to mention who was measuring it. Okay, that was the paradox. Maxwell found the speed of light, but there was no mention of which observer saw that speed. And that sounded weird because people thought that speeds depend on how fast you move. Speeds are relative. But here we see that according to relativity, which is the symmetry of the Maxwell equations, all observers are guaranteed to agree that the speed of light is this, that something moving at the speed of light moves at the speed of light. All observers will agree. So this the inconsistency between relativity, which goes back to Galileo, and Maxwell derivation of the speed of light is resolved. Okay, but it's resolved at a huge cost. The cost is that all of classical mechanics is wrong. Because all of classical mechanics was built on Galileo's idea about relativity, according to which different observers would see different velocities. So that's the cost, is we are now going to have to revise all of classical mechanics. And that's what happened with the theory of special relativity. So this leads to some amazing results. So let's talk about the most basic things in classical mechanics, which are how we measure where particles are and how they move. And therefore, we need to use clocks and rulers. So just in describing the motion of particles, we need clocks and rulers. And let's think about what a clock is. So a clock, we should put it in our space-time diagram, CT versus X. And what is a clock on that diagram? How would you describe a clock?
It's
on that diagram. By a clock, I mean something that ticks like once a second. Tick, 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 tick. Where is the clock on that diagram? Go straight up the, yeah, so a clock which is sitting at x equals 0, if my wrist is x equals 0, then, and the clock is my watch, then it doesn't move in x, okay, so, but it goes up the t-axis because t is advancing, and every second it ticks, and so ct changes by 3 times 10 to the 8 every second. Okay, so that's the, these are the ticks of the clock. Now, likewise, if let's draw, let's imagine a clock was moving. Okay, and I've got to close these axes to describe a moving clock. Here is the speed of light. Okay, this line is x equals ct, so that's the speed of light. Any clock moving with a speed less than the speed of light is going to be going up this axis. Okay, so this is the moving clock. The ticks of a moving clock. Because that clock should sit at x prime equals 0, i.e. on the t prime axis, and just go forward along the t prime axis. So for the moving clock, x prime equals 0 always, but t prime will be 0, 1, 2, 3. Okay, the ticks of the clock just advance by 1 second every tick. And so now we can figure out what x is. So what x and t are, so let's go up to that equation and see we have t and x in terms of x prime and t prime. So t is equal to, well, x prime is 0, and t prime is 0, 1, 2, 3. So obviously t is gamma, and it is t will be 0, gamma, 2 gamma, 3 gamma, okay, and x by the second, by the last formula up there, x prime is 0, t prime advances, so x is obviously equal to x is well, actually it's easier to go to the second equation, x prime is 0, so you see that x equals vt. So x is 0 times gamma v, 2 gamma v, da-da-da-da, which is just vt. So the clock that's moving, all right, second equation is saying the obvious thing, x is vt. Okay, it's moving. This equation is quite strange. It's saying that the, according to me, if I see a clock that's moving, the clock is ticking once a second. But according to me, it's ticking once every gamma seconds. Okay? So if gamma is a huge number, it only ticks very rarely. Okay, in other words, so this is called time dilation. And so a clock which is moving appears to run very slowly, according to the observer who's not moving. And this is observed every day of the week at the Large Hadron Collider. They send particles up to 0.999 the speed of light. They watch their behavior, their decays, and so on. And the decays are hugely slowed down by the fact that they're moving near the speed of light. In fact, another classic example is cosmic rays. You know, we detect cosmic rays from outer space that hit the Earth's upper atmosphere. So particles hit the Earth's upper atmosphere. They create a shower of particles, including muons, which are unstable. The muons have a certain lifetime,
But if the muons decayed in our coordinates with their standard, with their lifetime, with the same lifetime that they have in their rest frame, there wouldn't be enough time for them to make it to the Earth's, to ground. Okay, they would decay in the upper atmosphere, and we never see them on the ground. But cosmic rays are detected on the ground. And the way that happens is that the muons are moving very close to the speed of light, and even though the decay in their coordinates at a fixed rate, in our coordinates, takes much longer. And that's why we see them. So it was a puzzle how you could even see cosmic rays on the ground. How do they last so long when we know they decay too fast for us to see them? The puzzle was resolved by this time dilation effect. And you know, the way I like to summarize this is that if you want to stay young, you know, keep moving. The faster you move, everyone else will think, wow, you're staying young so well, right? Because then all you're doing is moving around very fast. Yeah?
You said that it was a puzzle how come that we see those particles.
Yeah.
So does it mean that we were detecting them even before Einstein's...
No, we weren't. I'm making up the history. No, we weren't. But it would have been a puzzle.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it was very direct evidence in favor of this idea. You know, what is just totally astonishing is 1905, you know, Einstein was so clear that this must be true, right? And yet there was essentially zero experimental evidence, okay? But Einstein was so convinced that this symmetry really is a symmetry of nature that he said it just must be this way. And if you read the papers, I mean, they're astonishing. They basically say, not only is this a symmetry of electromagnetism, but it must be a symmetry of everything. Anyone who invents a law of physics in the future, this will be a symmetry. Okay? So they were bold to the nth degree. So they were basically saying, when people study the laws of nuclear physics, of particle physics, whatever they do, they're going to find this is true. Okay? And they were right. It's incredible. They were totally right that this picture of the laws of physics has amazing power and validity. So, for example, you know, just 2 years ago, there was this claim that neutrinos are moving faster than the speed of light. And the reaction of most theoretical physicists, well, one of great excitement, lots of people here will walk around, yeah, great, you know, maybe relativity is wrong. But most theoretical physicists were saying, well, you know, if that's correct, we're going to have to revise everything, okay? All the agreements we have between theory and observations are all going to have to be revised. And because we've become so confident that the standard model fits particle physics so accurately, that sounds rather implausible. So most theorists who worked on, you know, particle physics and other physics were saying, you know, that problem is when you've got a symmetry and there's so much evidence for this symmetry, you know, and now you want to destroy it, the whole edifice of physics is going to collapse. So we're both excited but also skeptical that something so major would be true. And indeed, it turned out it was an experimental error. So, okay, so something equally interesting. I said clocks and rulers. Let's talk about rulers. So we measure distances with rulers, and we want to know, is everyone going to agree at least on what the length of an object is, or the on some distance? And the answer is no. People are not going to agree on what distances are. So let's do the same thing, CT and X. And so what is a ruler, or what is a measuring rod in this picture? How would I draw it? You know, what's the defining feature of a measuring object, an object that measures length.
Take a clock and spin it about.
Take a clock?
Take a clock and spin it about your x equals ctx.
Sorry, do you want to put it that way?
Yeah.
Like this?
Yeah. Yeah. I like literally take your watch and just flip it about CT, right?
Easy. Yes, so a measuring rod has to have two ends. Okay, that's all it needs, two ends separated by some definite distance. Okay, so I won't even bother with the other ticks of the rod. You're right, if it's an infinite rod or it's a tape, it should have multiple ticks. Let's just take two. So, but yeah, that's a good point. A measuring rod is just a clock going in the x direction. Okay, and so of course this end of the rod travels along that line in space-time. Okay, so we will call this end x equals 0, this end x equals L, and this measuring gadget will provide a coordinate, an x-coordinate, everywhere in space-time. So I'm going to do the same thing I did before. Let's consider a moving ruler. Okay, so TT X, this is a static stationary ruler. But I'm really interested in whether the moving guy is going to see the same distances as the stationary guy. So let's consider a moving ruler. And so one end of the ruler is going to be running up the CT prime axis. And the other one is going to be moving up another line parallel to that. So this will be x prime equals 0. That's one end of the ruler. And then the other end of the ruler is going to be going up here, x prime equals L. And the ruler, I should think about it in the CT prime coordinates. The ruler is this object, which at t prime equals 0 is here. Okay, this is t prime equals 0, this line. And then, of course, it just sort of moves upwards in space-time like this. So that's a moving ruler described at fixed time in the t prime coordinate system. Let's see what's the length of this ruler. In the O coordinates. So let's say, assume the length, so the ruler has length L, has in the O prime coordinates, L in the O prime coordinates. What is its length in the O coordinates? Well, you see, it's clear that in the O coordinates, this end of the ruler is not at the right time. Okay, if I want to measure the length of a ruler, I need to measure its length at a given time in the O coordinates. So I've got to, so even though here, this point has CT prime equals X prime equals 0, and also CT equals X equals 0. So this end of the ruler is good. I've got it at time T equals 0. But this end is not at the right time. So I've got to track it back to this point and ask, how far is this point from the origin? That will be the length of the ruler in the O coordinates. Okay, so how far do we have to track back? So this point here is at T equals 0, and of course X prime equal to L, because in the prime coordinates, this is the end of the ruler. Now T equals 0 implies, if we go to that formula up here, the third line, t equals 0, t T prime is minus V x prime over C squared. So T prime is minus V L over C squared. Okay, so instead of being at T prime equals zero, it's tracked back on this T prime in the T prime axis to this point. And now, of course, I can calculate what x is. So x is equal to gamma. This is from the final formula up there. X is gamma x prime plus vt prime. So gamma times L minus vl v squared L over c squared. So this is gamma times 1 minus v squared over c squared L. And remembering that gamma is 1 over square root of this factor, this is equal to 1 over gamma times L. So the length of the ruler is 1 over gamma L of ruler in the O coordinates is 1 over gamma times L. And this is called, and remembering that gamma is bigger than 1, this is called Lorentz contraction. It's a little bit generous to Lorentz because I think it was Einstein who figured out that Lorentz transformations correspond to time dilation and Lorentz contraction. So classical mechanics fails at step one in that different observers measure different times and different lengths. Now we're just going to prepare the next part of the discussion. I'm going to derive Einstein's, well, the most famous formula in physics, E equals mc squared. We'll do it in no less than 3 different ways, okay, to persuade you that it might actually be true. And so I'm just going to prepare for that discussion by elaborating what Einstein, what Maxwell knew, Maxwell and Maxwell's followers knew about the energy and momentum in the electromagnetic field. Okay, so there was some background around this that physicists knew by the time of Einstein that electromagnetic radiation moves at the speed of light, it carries energy, it carries momentum, and that fact was the key to understanding that it's possible to convert mass into energy. Okay? It was all implicitly there in electromagnetism. So I'm going to say a little about electromagnetism and then and that was the basis for Einstein's other 1905 paper, okay, where he derived the formula E equals mc squared in 3 pages and without any references. He didn't need to refer to Maxwell, I guess. Everybody knew about Maxwell. And by the way, at the time of Einstein's paper, 1905, people didn't really understand what energy and momentum were. Okay? People knew that there's something called energy, it's conserved. There's something called momentum, it's conserved. They didn't really, really understand. What do I mean by really understand? I mean why there is something called energy which is conserved and why there's something called momentum which is conserved. Do you know who the person is who understood that and when they did it?
Emmy Noether.
Emmy Noether, okay. And when did they When did she do it?
I want to say around 1900, but I don't know the year.
1915, the same year Einstein invented general relativity, Emmy Noether discovered a symmetry argument which showed why energy is a conserved quantity, why momentum is a conserved quantity. And you see, energy is conserved because of the symmetry of space, symmetry of physics under translations in time. If I do an experiment today, or if I do it tomorrow, I'll get the same result if the world hasn't changed between today and tomorrow. Okay? And that's a symmetry, that it hasn't changed between today and tomorrow. And the consequence is that energy is conserved. And Emmy Noether discovered that. And secondly, if I do the experiment here, or if I do it there, and if the physical conditions are the same here as there, in other words, there's a symmetry under space, momentum is conserved. And Emmy Noether understood the connection between symmetry under translation in space and momentum. This was not really appreciated in 1905, and it's one of the most important insights, profound insights into physics, laid the basis for the entire field of particle physics in the 20th century, which was all about finding the symmetries and the conserved quantities related to them. Yeah?
Can you tell me the specific examples of energy and momentum?
Yes. She gave an argument which was completely general. In fact, I will give you the argument. Maybe I'll do it in the next lecture. It's a totally simple argument, but an argument which everyone had missed. Newton, Maxwell, Hamilton, Poincaré, all these people had missed this very profound fact. Okay? And now, because we're talking about time and space, and we're unifying them, according to Noether, no surprise that the conserved quantities associated with shifts in time or shifts in space have to be related. And that's what the four momentum is. It's a quantity which involves energy and momentum, and they are related, and the reason they exist, the reason the four momentum exists is because of translation invariant in space-time. And so energy and momentum are intimately related. So because Einstein didn't know that, I'm going to give you just a quick, and it's sort of an excuse to tell you a little bit more information about electromagnetism. I'm going to give you a quick discussion about energy and momentum in the electromagnetic field. I haven't got much time, so I'm only going to start. Magnetic field. So Maxwell and others realized there must be energy in the field. I mean, the field is carrying light, and light can transmit heat, and therefore there's got to be energy in this field. And they worked out that the energy density, okay, so maybe I'll call it rho E to distinguish it. Maybe that's a bad notation. Let me call it rho N, okay? Because I've used rho for charge density. This is the energy density, rho energy, and this is a half epsilon naught E squared plus 1/2 B squared over mu naught. And that's the expression for the energy density in the electric and magnetic fields. And then the energy flux, and that is the rate of transfer of energy per unit area per unit time, Jn. So these are the analogs of the same quantities for electric charge, but they're entirely expressed in terms of the electromagnetic field. This is 1 over mu naught times E cross B, and this was discovered by Poynting. A wonderful name, because the Poynting vector points in the direction that the electromagnetic energy is traveling. Okay, and the main result here is that the time rate of change of the energy density is minus the divergence of the Poynting vector. So this was figured out by people in the 19th century. And, you know, if our formalism of relativity is any use at all, it really should incorporate these things. We should be able to write those things in a much nicer way, too. Okay? And indeed, that is the case, that these combine to form the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor, it's actually a bigger quantity than just rho and j, but it includes rho and j. And the formula is the following, that T mu nu, it's a symmetric two-index tensor. And the it's given by 1 over mu naught. And then it's quadratic in the field strength. And so as you can see from over there, so it's alpha mu f alpha nu minus 1/4 eta mu nu times f alpha beta. So you can write down this quantity, quadratic in the field strength tensor. And if you work out the different components, you will find that T0, 0 is equal to rho, and T0i is equal to j. These are energy. Okay, and the main property of it is that the divergence, the four-dimensional divergence, d mu t mu nu, okay, if d mu is just d by dx mu. So the four-dimensional divergence means that I take a derivative and I contract the index with one of the two indices of the stress tensor. So we can do that easily enough. So let's take Maxwell with no currents or charges. So if I take Maxwell with j mu, the electric current equal to 0, so just ordinary electromagnetic fields and nothing else, then the divergence of T mu nu over here, I'm going to get, you see the first term, I'm going to get d mu f alpha mu, but this is 0 by the first Maxwell equation, because there's no current. Then over here, I'm going to get f alpha mu d mu f alpha nu. And from this term, I'm going to get minus. Now, the eta converts my partial derivative mu into partial derivative nu with an index raised. That derivative acts on these guys, but this is quadratic. So when I differentiate a square of something, I just get twice its value, so I get minus 1/2 d nu f alpha beta, and this will give me one half mu naught. Now this term here, you see, this is antisymmetric under alpha and mu. So I can write this term as, put a half and write d mu f alpha minus d alpha f mu. Okay? So this would, and that's helpful, as you see in a second. So I've taken the half out, and then I write d mu f alpha nu minus d alpha f mu nu. And then I have minus 1/2 f alpha beta d nu f alpha beta. And now you see where I'm going, which is that Maxwell's the second Maxwell equation, in the first form I wrote it, which is just df plus cycles is 0, I have three terms. Yeah?
Shouldn't the d contract the derivative?
Say again?
Shouldn't the beta on top of the first
term? Oh, yeah, you're right.
It's not beta, it's mu.
Why did I? Sorry, yes. Thank you.
Mu.
That's right? So so all I have to do is combine these terms. And this is 1 over 2 mu naught. Now, f is antisymmetric. So let us mentally imagine lowering this index.
You don't need a half on this third term, right?
Sorry, there's a half outside. Thank you. Sorry, lots of mistakes. No half there. In this term, you see, if I lower the nu index, switch the nu and mu, and raise the nu index, I get a minus sign. So basically, I end up with f alpha mu, and then d mu f alpha nu plus d alpha f nu mu. Okay, so I'm trying to be careful that this new index was second in this formula, but now it's shifted over to first. And when I flip the order of the new and mu indices, I got a minus sign. And then let's combine it with this guy. So that is just plus d nu f nu alpha. So you notice I've relabeled the indices. Alpha, beta, has become alpha mu, mu alpha. So I've relabeled beta equal to mu, and because I've switched the order, I put a minus sign. Okay, but this is zero, because that quantity is zero by Maxwell's second equation. Second equation, which is just that d alpha f gamma delta plus cycles equals zero. Okay, so what we've shown is that according to Maxwell's equations with no currents, this quantity is the divergence of the stress energy tensor is zero. That will be enough to show that there are a set of quantities, energy and momentum, which are conserved. It's enough to show, in fact, what it shows is this equation plus another equation, which gives you the conservation law for momentum. So we'll do that next time. Any other questions? No questions. There must be some. While you're thinking of a question, let me just emphasize one other theme in relativity, electromagnetism and relativity, which is unification. Okay. What's happened is Maxwell succeeded in putting electric and magnetic fields together into one quantity. So he unified electricity with magnetism. Einstein and Lorentz unified space and time. Okay. This whole notion that physics could be simplified and unified, simplified through unifying it, okay, is what set the whole agenda for 20th century fundamental physics. People were trying to simplify by unifying. And if we look at where we are today, there are certain sort of strange things we don't understand. Probably the strangest is the energy in the vacuum. We know from cosmology this energy in the vacuum, vacuum energy. We don't know what it is. We don't know how to unify it with the other parts of physics. Similarly with the Higgs boson, there are big questions. How exactly does it manage to consistently unify with other areas of physics? How do we unify gravity, quantum gravity, with the rest of physics? So this theme, you know, what we're doing throughout this course is basically trying to unify things in order to simplify, them. So now there must be a question. No questions. Okay, I was too clear. I'll try and be more confusing. I'll try and be more confusing next time. All right. Well, you have a bit of a break.